Money, Riches, and Wealth is sponsored by the Financial Consulate. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli and Tim Maurer.
And this is Drew Tignanelli here with Timothy J. Maurer. Timothy,
present.
How are you?
Yes, sir.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Very well. And here you're going to another concert. Last day, you said.
Oh, it was last night. I did.
Really?
I went to see the Dave Matthews Band.
That sounds like a waste of time.
No, trust me when I tell you. And in fact, it was the Lumineers opening up for the Dave Matthews Band. It was a phenomenal show.
Oh, I tell you, you must have been in heaven on that one, Tim. That's good.
Drew, the sarcasm is dripping off those nice, shiny,
Headphones
you got
These
there.
These are my rock headphones
I know.
I got to give Rock Applebaum a lot of credit and praise for these headphones. I love them. They're fantastic.
Yeah. He's a
anyway.
Great guy.
We have a special guest tonight.
We do.
I don't have a Drew's View, so we're
come
gonna
on.
Go. No, I really didn't think about it today.
I didn't think about anything. But I am happy to introduce tonight's guest. If you're
we
ready
did already it. Talk about that, if you're going to sell a stock for a gain, sell it in 2012.
Well,
we talked about that last week.
That's a reasonable reminder, though.
Yeah,
because
a good reminder.
One of the things that you and I were even talking about just over the course of the last week that you were clarifying for me is that the capital gains tax rate is definitely going up because of the Healthcare Act.
Yeah, Medicare, 3.8% of capital gains. If your income, single, is over $200,000, married is over $250,000, it is not maybe going up.
Right.
It is
That's not a part of this fiscal cliff thing. That's happening.
You're not going to be paying 15% anymore. You're paying 18.8%. And if they get their way with the side that wants to raise taxes, it's going to 23.8%.
Yeah.
But the point is, you're already up. So sell now if you're going to sell anyway.
If you were intending to sell
anyway. If you're intending to sell, that's the issue.
Right.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
Here's our guest.
Moshe Silver has spent 3 decades on Wall Street and is Managing Director and Chief Compliance Officer at Hedgeye Risk Management, a group for which we have a lot of esteem, Drew. In addition to his Columbia MBA, Moshe's depth and breadth of experience are unique for a compliance professional. He was a producing broker at Bear Stearns and Payne Webber, and more recently a hedge fund compliance officer at Millennium and Carlyle Blue Wave Partners. In between, he has run brokerage branch operations and been director of compliance at the regional, national, and global level. Moshe's talent with language and expertise with a pen, which we're going to talk about tonight, make him a multiple threat player. He authors the regular Hedgeye featured column Slouching Towards Wall Street and scours the Latin American press daily to add detail and the occasional scoop to Hedgeye's in-depth coverage of Brazil. Tonight, we will also be talking to him about his ebook, Fixing a Broken Wall Street. Moshe, thank you for joining us tonight.
I'm delighted to be here with you, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be talking about what it is that we do.
Yeah. So how do we fix a broken Wall Street? Let's start by finding out what's broken about it. I mean, I think everybody pretty much knows, but my guess is you can articulate this better than most.
Well, I think we've gotten to a point where, let me preface everything by saying that I consider it a tremendous blessing, and I'm incredibly fortunate to be here in America today. I embrace capitalism. I believe in what it is that we do, and I believe in our industry.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I have to preface what I'm going to say through the course of the hour by saying that, because if you've read my columns and if you've read my book, and as you will hear as we discuss this tonight, I've got a pretty dim view of an awful lot that goes on in our industry.
Sure.
And I think that, it may not be too bold a statement to say that we've gotten to a point where our industry has really embedded corruption as an operating procedure. And it's almost the first choice as a business model in many cases.
Now, you're referring to Wall Street now, right?
I'm referring to Wall Street, to the finance industry in general, yeah. When I was at Bear Stearns back in the 80s, there are some listeners who may remember that there used to be a brokerage and investment banking firm by that name. Ace Greenberg, who was the legendary CEO of the firm at the time, he made an observation that as the bull market was really taking off and more money was pouring into the industry, he said when there's a big inflow of cash into any area of activity, it always attracts the worst people.
Hmm.
And he made an early call, you know, back in the, as I remember, it was around the mid-80s, you know. I started in the industry in 1982, so he made, I believe his call was like around 85, 86, saying, you know, this bull market is going to attract an awful lot of bad actors.
Hmm.
And I think he was on the money. And there's a second part of that, which is that unlike many other industries, like manufacturing a car,
right,
or running a tool and die shop,
mm-hmm,
or sewing dresses, you don't need a skill to move money around.
Yeah.
So the combination of seeing too much money running around with nobody particularly controlling it, and realizing that you didn't have to have any particular training in order to be at one of those inflection points where the money moved and be able to take a little piece for yourself, it really created a balloon of, you know, every industry has bad actors. I think it may be fair to say that we have more than our fair share.
Well, let me ask you this question. Do you think that since 2008, the decks have been cleaned and that the place is a little more shipshape, or is it worse?
You know, I don't know. I'm not sure I can give you a straight up-down answer on that. I think 2008... I was just like going back and looking through some of my notes this afternoon, getting ready to speak with you gentlemen. There's a great quote from Chris Cox, who in 2008 was the head of the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
And Cox had been brought in by George W. Bush, really kind of with a mandate to, you know, temper the what was then seen as excessive regulation on the street
around, right,
2005. And then came 2007, 2008, and Cox said that it was a big awakening to him and a real shock that the voluntary regulation model wasn't working. Because he said if you take these huge financial institutions and you give them the option to opt out of regulation, they're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So my question is, what kind of legislative process, what kind of regulatory thought process, and what kind of society creates a regulatory infrastructure whose whole purpose is to be turned off when it's needed?
Hmm. That's a good point.
Yeah,
that's a very good point.
We're living with the aftermath of that today, I think.
So we have to take a break real quick, but the question I want to ask you, and you can answer it after the break, or you can give me a yes or a no if you want to just do it simple, is if you were an investor out there, you know, the general person listening to our show, if they were a general investor out there, would they be wise to invest money with a brokerage firm, or is that too broad a question?
I'll give you my quick answer now, which is I'm a compliance officer, not a money manager.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I do have some thoughts on that for after the break.
Great.
All right, Moshe, we'll be back with Money, Riches, and Wealth after this break with Terry Troyek.
WCBM.
When December rolls around and old man winter comes to town, from every port of call, it's the one that tops them all.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
I guess this is a kind of a Christmas holiday song, right, Noah? Yeah? Well, you could do the Dave Matthews Band just so we can prove to Tim
actually
how bad that concert really was.
No. And get this. Dave Matthews has a song called A Christmas Song. You will find that, Noah, and we will have it at next break, right?
There you go.
I know I can count
all
on you,
right,
buddy.
We're here. We have Moshe Silver as our guest. Moshe, are you a music kind of guy? I'm not. Tim is.
Well, that's a subject for another show. I'm not a Dave Matthews type of guy. Nothing against Dave Matthews.
I understand. So, Moshe, what would be your type of guy? What type of guy are you? Who's one of your top two, three?
Music.
I don't think I don't think Puccini composed a bad note.
Yeah,
well,
I'm a big fan of classical music as well. Messiah is by
Tim's got a broad spectrum of music he likes. I have a very limited one, but anyway.
And I've been, I've been not a deep aficionado, but a very content listener of very good jazz.
Yeah,
and
there
I'm
you
married
go.
To a Grateful Dead fan. What can I tell you?
Hey, that's what a great mix. I love it.
So yeah, there's eclecticism in our household.
Sorry, Moshe. You know, you're an investor listening to this show, and here's a guy coming on. He's written a book, How to Fix Wall Street. That means that it's still broken right this point in time. And you're a compliance officer. So from a compliance officer's point of view, would you be telling the average listener that, yeah, you should be working with Wall Street? There's nothing wrong with working with the big brokerage firms.
Well, I would say that there's a fundamental problem, which just to say it very briefly, we are and pride ourselves on being the greatest capitalist society in the history of societies. And yet we don't teach capitalism in our schools.
Hmm.
It's kind of shocking to me that an American kid can graduate from a very good high school and not understand double entry bookkeeping or compound interest.
Sure.
When you go to managing your own money, you have to look for a professional.
Right.
Secret is that we like to keep it that way. We like people to believe that what we do is so complicated that they can never possibly understand it. That's why they have to keep on paying us fees and commissions to do it for them. But there's some things that the average intelligent person can look at, not need to be an expert, and still be protected. And when I say protected, to me the big, and I think to the average individual investor, the big point that they're looking for is not a guarantee that they're going to make a certain amount of money or that they're going to make more money than their next-door neighbor or that they're going to be able to brag about their brokerage account at cocktail parties, because that's really all hype.
Yep.
What they're looking for is a professional and this is one of the first lessons that I learned from my first branch manager in the business, and it's still true today, somebody that they like personally, somebody that they feel they can trust, and somebody whose knowledge of the markets they respect.
Right.
It's got to be somebody that they are convinced has their best interests at heart. And they will then be able to ride with them through the ups and downs, because nobody makes money on every trade. Except
that's true. Now, here's the point, though. Here's the point, and that is that the industry doesn't operate under a standard where you have to work in the best interest of the person. And there's been a big debate about the concept of what is known as a fiduciary standard, working in the best interest of the company. And there's a dogfight over this. Which I find amazing. How do you fight over the issue of wanting to do the best for the client? But there's a dogfight over it.
Well, you folks, you run a registered advisor.
We are independent registered advisors. We are absolutely fiduciaries.
And you are exactly. So you are very happily and willingly bound to the fiduciary standard.
Absolutely. Yep.
I started out in the retail brokerage business, which, as you know, is what they call the suitability standard.
Right.
And suitability means that if you, Mr. or Miss Investor, come to me and say, yeah, I can afford to take that loss and I understand what I'm doing, and you're willing to sign that piece of paper, I can get away with an awful lot.
Yep.
Okay. And I can win the arbitration.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you have to.
So it's clear why they're fighting over the fiduciary standard. But at the same time, I think that individual investors, if they understand a couple of things, one thing is just the kind of the mechanism of trading in the marketplace, a lot of the juice has been squeezed out of the average equity trades. When I started in the business, the standard spread on an over-the-counter trade was an eighth of a point or a quarter of a point. Okay, so you're talking about a built-in commission of 12.5 cents a share, which was considered standard on many stock trades.
Yeah.
All right, 2, 3, 4, 5% of the total value of the trade would be paid in commissions, right? Now we're down to fractions of a penny.
Right.
So there's a lot less juice in it for the broker, the transactional broker, to make money on just, as we, to use the pejorative term, spinning or churning a customer's account,
mm-hmm.
right? There are reputable firms, there are great firms out there that have professionals who are registered under the advisory fiduciary standard, and whose job is to bring the investor suitable and appropriate types of investments. And So the first thing I would urge an investor to do is check what standard the firm that you're contemplating doing business with adheres to.
Yeah.
Are they a straightforward, you know, brokerage firm which only applies what we call the suitability standard, meaning you're kind of on your own, which is not to say that people who work for those firms are all bad or out to get you, but it's a little bit it's structured a little less to the advantage and benefit of the investor. If you're dealing with a firm that is registered under a fiduciary standard, then you have a legal and a regulatory right to expect a little more careful treatment with your money. I think the other thing to look at is the kind of, you know, how the broker or the advisory professional is getting compensated. You know, are they compensated on transactions? Are they compensated on assets under management? It's perfectly okay to ask, you know, why am I buying, this S&P 500 index fund instead of the one with a recognizable name?
Well, and Moshe, you make a good point, too. I think investors should be perfectly willing and feel able to ask their advisor, how exactly are you compensated and who's paying you?
Yeah, I would agree.
And, you know, there's so many products that are basically identical. And as you gentlemen well know, because, you know, you see this, I'm sure, in your business all the time, you have a spread of, you know, you pick a dozen S&P 500 index funds, and you've probably got off the top of my head, I guess you probably have maybe as much as a 200 basis point spread in the fees across those funds, maybe
yeah,
even more.
Absolutely.
Like,
you
know, yeah, no
one,
question.
2-3 percentage point difference in how much fee the investor's going to pay.
No question.
Well, I had a client today, Moshe. The husband and wife come in, and she was at a bank, and the bank manager, you know, says to her, you know, hey, you know, you want to set up a college fund for your kids? I can set up a college fund for you. And, you know, a lot of people don't know when they're dealing with bank managers, they're dealing with a broker who's working under a suitability standard. And this broker talks her into buying a 529 plan in a state that allows them to take a 5% commission of everything she's putting away for her grandchildren. And with no state of Maryland income tax deduction. So if she would have used the Maryland T. Rowe Price plan, she would have got in for no commissions. She would have gotten in a Maryland income tax deduction.
Mm-hmm.
There were no fees to establish it.
Right.
The annual expenses of the mutual funds are lower. It's a better fund class. If I told her to do something different than the Maryland 529, I could be literally liable as a fiduciary.
Sure.
He has no responsibility whatsoever of selling that. It was perfectly legal for him to do that.
Yep.
Right. And that's built into that's kind of what I'm talking about. That type of that penchant for abuse is it's built in structurally into the industry.
Yeah. But here's the question, Moshe. Do you know this guy writes this book called Why I Left Goldman or something like that, you know? And anyway, and there are a lot of people giving him a hard time saying, yeah, but you stayed there for 10 years. It took you 10 years to figure out that you ought to leave. Now, you were in Wall Street for 30 years. Why is it 30 years that it took you to want to write a book about how to fix it? That's a fair question.
Fair question. I've been talking and doing things in my own life and in my own business practice. I like to think that I've been doing things the right way and studying how to do things the right way a lot longer than just the last couple of years. Without going into too much detail and naming names, there have been firms where I've been, you know, pretty well compensated, where I've left because I saw that I wasn't going to be able to,
do what you felt was right.
Well, I wasn't going to be able to promote the right type of, you know, there's doing business according to the letter of the law, and then there's doing business according to the spirit of the law.
Right.
And if you can't get the spirit, you at least get the letter. And if it looks like you're not going to get the letter, then you have a choice of either we'll take another, you know, $50,000 bonus, or we'll go look for a job someplace else.
Right.
So, you know, another point you can make is, hey, Drew and Tim, you two aren't lily white either, because I was 15 years in a brokerage firm. Tim was
seven.
Tim went 7 years. He hopped, skipped, and jumped to all kinds of different
banks,
organizations.
Banks, brokerage firms, insurance companies, Drew. I was on a search for truth.
it's a very seductive business. I don't need to tell you. The gentlemen are both in it.
Yeah.
You know, they're... as I say in some of my more cynical moments, you know, where else in the world can a person do, I mean, if you did a job like this in a manufacturing company, you'd be making, you know, 20% of what you're taking home today, if that.
Right.
You know, if you did a job like this in a retail chain company, you know. So we're a phenomenally overpaid industry by most standards.
Right.
And, thank God, I'm still employed, you know. So,
hold on for me, Moshe, because I got to take my next break, and I'm going to come back, and we're going to talk about your solutions for Wall Street. Right now, I got to go to territory and traffic.
The wise men came, three made their way to shower him with love while he lay in the hay. Shower him with love.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
What is it about groups like the Mumford Twins that you like, these guys that just kind of mumble along while people play instruments?
Drew, one of these days we're going to have a whole show. In fact, you committed. We're going to have a show dedicated to music. This is quality stuff. Yeah, you, it was your idea.
Yeah, we were going to take a vote if anybody actually likes this kind of stuff.
And you know they do.
Yeah, we're going to find out.
Moshe's wife does. I know that for a fact.
She likes the Grateful Dead.
Then she's got to be a fan of Dave Matthews. He's kind of a, you know.
Moshe, you go home and write us an email tomorrow, okay?
I'll have a word with the wife. We'll get
or maybe you are home right now. And you can ask her. Come on the air and tell us if you like Dave Matthews.
Yeah.
Anyway, so your book
is Fixing Wall Street.
How to Fix Wall Street. So tell us, what is your solution? What do you do to fix it?
Well, let me give you one or two concrete examples, recommendations that we make in the book. I'll give you a very, very quick background. Just paint a picture very, very quickly.
Well, before you do, let me ask you a quick question. All right, when you say fix Wall Street, does this just include the big wirehouse brokerage firms, or are you including private equity, hedge funds, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I think let's hit on what I devote half the book to, which is, I think, one of the biggest problems, as I said at the beginning of our conversation, that corruption has become embedded almost as a first choice business plan for a lot of, across our industry.
Right.
That's not, you know, only with respect to the individual retail customer.
And you say that's still true today.
I think it's absolutely true today. In certain respects, it's more true than ever. When Bob Kuzami came on board as the new head of the SEC, head of enforcement, you know, Kuzami had an incredible record behind him as a prosecutor, you know, literally risking his life to go after drug dealers and winning some really major cases when he was in the New York prosecutor's office. When he got to the SEC, he announced that his program was to get bigger settlements than ever before.
Okay. So that's why the insider trading things that you've been seeing and so forth.
All that great stuff.
Yeah.
All that great stuff. And, you know, what they're saying is that not just that crime pays, but now it's actually got a price list.
Right.
Take a look at HSBC. Right? They just announced a $1.9 billion settlement because for, I don't remember how many years, they looked the other way while they, in the United States, laundered money for Mexican drug gangs and for the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, among other.
It's a pretty powerful indictment.
Savory characters, right?
Yeah.
The deal that they made was they're going to pay $1.9 billion fine. Now, that $1.9 billion, according to Bloomberg, is less than their average quarterly profit.
Wow.
See, that's what's amazing to me.
So for less than one quarter's profit, then we have no idea how much they've taken in over the years. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, Moshe, that's what's amazing to me, and I think so many listeners and folks who are looking at this situation, you would tend to think that a company who had a $1.9 billion fine to pay would be out of business. But for them, it's a quarter.
It's a quarter.
I mean, that's pretty
amazing.
Yeah, but,
you know, the amazing thing is why they would even want to do business with Mexican drug bands or you know, gangs and so forth. It's probably a lot of money, but compared to $1 billion of profit, they're probably not that big a deal to them.
Yeah,
would you say?
Imagine.
You know, I don't know. Remember, it's cash business. Remember, there are a lot of other tie-ins. We don't know all of the details. I know just from what's available out there, what you can read in, you know, books that have been written by people who've gone, for example, undercover on currency stings and on money laundering operations and stuff like that. You know, these operations typically reach to extremely high levels of government. And when you are when you're dealing, I'm not saying that it happened in this case or not, but you know, if you're dealing with, well, there was a corruption case in Brazil, for example, where the head of the military joint chiefs of staff was at the top of the pyramid of people who were on the take from the drug gangs on the streets. Okay, so if you're dealing at that level of government, you know, there's obviously an awful lot more going on than just, you know, getting a penny per $100,000 that you wash through your system or whatever fees they're charging to process those cash transfers.
Wow.
But
okay,
at the same time, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, go ahead.
No, just the very concept that they can even countenance a settlement in a case like this.
Yeah.
So the chapter that I wrote about this in the book is called HSBC, 50,000 Dead Mexicans Can't Be Wrong. I mean, how many lives were lost of, you know, Mexico has been in a state of civil war for years over this drug crisis.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know how many Mexicans were killed, how many Americans were killed, and how many people of other nationalities were killed as a direct result of cash that flowed through HSBC's offices. And all they're doing is writing a check for $1.9 billion. They're not even giving us a person and saying, yeah, it was this man, this woman, these three people, this office. They're not even giving us the name of a person or persons and saying, you know what, they were the ones who were responsible.
Wow.
So one of the proposals that I make in the book is, and this is something where we don't need to go to Congress, because that's a total waste of time. We're going to get another law passed, forget about it. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but we do have the ability in the current regulatory structure, the SEC, as a matter of course, when they enter into these settlements, they could require, depending on, you know, the amount of money involved, the magnitude of the alleged crime, et cetera, they could insist on having name or names of persons put in those settlements. And, it, you know, for my money, it would be, okay, here's the story. You're the CEO of HSBC. We're putting your name in this settlement as the person who was responsible for the money laundering, unless you want to give us a list of other people, and then we'll take your name out and put theirs in. Trust me, you'll get a name.
Hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Now, what happens now is, you know, people want justice. People are really angry, and I totally get it. They see something like this happen. They want those bankers thrown in prison where they're going to be beat and abused by their cellmates and where they're going to be murdered. And you know, maybe morally that's right. But that's not the way the world works. And what the way the world works is that the company is going to indemnify their executives. They're going to pay their fines. They're going to pay their legal fees. You know what? Fine. But as a first step, once that person's name is in that settlement document, as the person who was responsible for the activity, even if they're, you know, even if they're protected by law from any future legal action, they can never work in the industry again.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So first step, at least let's get the bad actors out of the industry. Let them go drive a truck or do something else.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. You know, I remember, you remember a guy named Fred Carr? Fred Carr was the go-go era mutual fund guy whose fund went bankrupt, basically. And then he went on to do Executive Life of New York, which went bankrupt and so forth. You know, and it wasn't nearly as corrupt as what you're talking about. But it's amazing how the bad apples can just continue to recycle through the industry. There's nothing really ever shifts them out of there. I bet you Madoff, if he got out of prison, he could come right back into the industry.
Hey, politicians do it.
I'm just kidding.
You know, there's two things. I mean, Madoff, because he's so, you know, in the mind of the public, he's so evil and so notorious that he would find some champions somewhere. But, you know, the other secret that people don't know is in the brokerage industry, you know, there are these, it happens over and over and over again. You get somebody who runs up a certain number of customer complaints, cost the firm a lot of money to settle them, and the firm tells the person, you know what, do us a favor, give us your letter of resignation, go find a job someplace else. Because if they mark down on their regulatory record that they had to pay settlements and that they had to discipline them, then they get hit with charges of failure to supervise,
right,
and it becomes a permanent record of the firm. So there's a long, long history all across Wall Street of these what I call fraudulent referrals.
Hmm.
where the worst brokers are just allowed to resign and they go work for another firm.
Because it's quieter.
Moshe, you're going to have to hold on for us. We're coming into the last part of our show, but right now I've got to get Timmy to tell us what we need to know. We'll take a break and then we'll be right back. Timmy, what do we need to know?
Thank you, Andrew. You need to know the only market prediction you'll need for 2013. Yes, it's that time of year again when Christmas trees are raised, stockings are hung, and menorahs are lit. When chestnuts roast and wassail simmers. When friends and family come together in joyous unity. And when Wall Street prognosticators send a series of mixed and conflicting messages in an attempt to predict what the market will do next year. And while I may not have the cranial capacity of these market mystics, I was gifted with a reasonably functional BS meter, and it tells me that most of these financial fortune tellers are full of it. There certainly are a number of issues that seem to be facing us as headwinds. The so-called fiscal cliff and $16 trillion in national debt on the home front. Europe sliding ever closer into a continental depression, and a Middle East that appears to be on the verge of imploding. But on the positive side, we have cash-rich companies with increased productivity anxious to put it to good use. Could we run the gauntlet of scary stuff and find our way to market highs? Sure. Or could we see a perfect storm of economic and geopolitical nightmares converge in another 2008? Or worse? Of course. The only thing you can really count on is uncertainty and change. That said, it is always our recommendation that you err on the side of conservatism when establishing the posture of your portfolio. Because, after all, it's easier to lose money than it is to make it. But once you've made informed decisions regarding your allocation, I recommend turning your gaze away from this proliferation of news over which you have little to no control and refocusing your efforts on that which is under your personal purview. You're likely to gain a great deal more satisfaction out of the coming year if you focus the majority of your efforts, concerns, and strategizing on those things in life over which you have control instead of those that you don't. And that is something you need to know.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
So, Moshe, did he get it?
I want to thank you, gentlemen, for digging that one up.
Yeah. There you go. Way to go, Noah.
We aim to please, Moshe.
Noah Dankner, our producer. He's the man of the hour.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen. And by the way, we should mention Moshe.
Understood my needs.
There you go.
Moshe, before we forget to mention this, how can people get a hold of your new ebook?
Or how can they just follow some of the things you write?
Yeah, we published it direct to Kindle.
Okay.
And the title is Fixing a Broken Wall Street. And so as your listeners presumably know, you don't need a Kindle device.
No.
You need a Kindle app.
Right.
Which you can download for free onto any computer.
Yep.
And go onto Amazon and just type in Fixing a Broken Wall Street, and you'll see it right there.
Off to the races.
And then post a 5-star rave review about what it was.
Of course, of course.
Now, you can also get in touch with you and follow some of the things that you and Keith and Daryl are doing at HedgeEye.com, right?
Yes, that's our website, which opens up to our various suite of offerings for institutional and professionals such as yourselves and for individual investors.
Yeah. And you see, HedgeEye is a lot like, you know, Tim and I, as we said, we're kind of repenting brokers, sort of. And, you know, HedgeEye is a lot like the financial consulate. In other words, your firm is dedicated to trying to bring professional advice with a higher standard to do the best you can for the people that you serve. And I admire it. That's one of the reasons why we've been such a big admirer mm-hmm. of HedgeEye.com.
Thank you.
Anyway, here's a question. You know, the two big corruptions we've already talked about is money laundering and insider trading. So what are other corruptions that's going on Wall Street that we have to fix?
Well, I think there's a structural issue which, you know, corruption may be too strong a word to describe it, but it's really, it preys on individual investors over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, what's that?
And the reality in every industry is most people are not that smart. But some people are really smart, get to succeed because they're competing with people who think they're doing the same thing, but they're not doing it at anywhere near their level.
Mm-hmm.
Right? As John Maynard Keynes once said, businessmen are the stupidest people on the planet. And when he was asked, well, if that's so, how come some of them are so very successful? He said, because they compete against other businessmen. But if you look at, for example, here's the example I want to share, which is the hedge fund world. I don't know the exact number, but it's over 95% of hedge funds out there are 90+%. 90+% of the hedge funds in the industry are over 90% correlated to each other.
Wow.
And that group is in turn over 90% correlated to the broad market averages.
Wow.
Which means that if you put your money with a hedge fund, your rate of return is likely to be equivalent to buying a no-load index fund.
Right.
However, you get to pay them a 2% management fee.
Yeah.
Even in down years.
And possibly a 20% performance fee.
Hey, right, if they happen to get lucky and make some money.
Right.
Right. Now, you take a look. I just happen to have here Wall Street Journal from December 7th. Headline is Fidelity Offering Hedge Fund Play. I'm not picking on Fidelity, but it just happens to be the story that I saw and that I wrote about today. We see this over and over and over and over again. Very smart people create unique ways to capitalize on what we call market inefficiencies. The hedge fund.
Right.
The ETF, that was a professional, very complex professional trading tool. And I used to actually, you know, when I was working in the hedge fund side, on trading desks, I would oversee the construction of ETFs. It's a really, really complex process.
Yeah.
Way beyond my skills. Okay. The ETF has now become a retail product.
Mm-hmm.
The hedge fund is now becoming a retail product. Private equity is now becoming a retail product. So I would say that any individual investor, you go to your professional, whether it's a broker or a fiduciary such as yourselves, if they start saying to you, well, there's a new hedge fund product out here that you can buy for $5,000, $20,000 investment, whatever it is.
Right.
You have to say, well, but hedge funds are supposed to be the smart money. If they're so smart, why am I getting a chance to invest in it?
Right.
They're so smart that they've already realized that they can't make any more money doing it themselves, which is why they're going to let you pay them a fee.
Right.
Yeah, and you don't find, there's only so much great talent out there, and those the real great talent tend to stay very private, like Ray Dalio of Bridgewater. You're not going to find a Ray Dalio in every hedge fund you go to.
Oh, and he's not inviting me to write him a check for $25,000 to participate in his next hedge fund. But there's so many products out there that have now become common products for the average individual investor. Stock options, futures, indexes, ETFs.
Right.
They're like bread and butter products out there. Well, they all started as very cleverly designed investment tools that were put together by some brilliant person who saw an opportunity to put together two pieces in the market that should have fit together, and nobody else saw that. Nobody else saw the opportunity. Okay, and now they're out there, and people are losing money with them.
Well, one of the things that I also think, and we only have a minute to go, but one of the other things that I've seen is how often they have a product that they would never put any of their own money in. They write emails with
right.
each other about joking about selling this stuff and, and saying all kinds of derogatory
piece
things
of
to
junk.
It, and then they're on the phone selling it to people.
As a compliance officer, I got to tell you, the subject of what not to write in an email is very near and dear to my
heart. Yeah, I bet it is.
That's a whole other book.
Yeah,
but obviously, when you look at congressional hearings and so forth, they don't listen.
Well, it's kind of astonishing when you see all these people with all these high-powered educations, these guys who go to MIT and they learn how to design rocket propulsion engines, and
yeah.
they come out and they put stuff like this in an email.
But it's still there.
Still put no intelligence.
Anyway, Moshe, we really appreciate you coming on with us. I mean, it's just a great talk. We could talk about it day and night. We think that the industry really needs to be revised.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
God willing, we're all going to be out there in the forefront together.
Amen. Go. Moshe, we really appreciate it, and we hope that you have a great holiday season here now.
To you and all your listeners.
All right, sir. Well, anyway, we'll be back next week.
We will. Open show.
All right. Open show. This is Money, Rich, and Wealth. Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.
Radio 680 double.